Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Telecom Regulation and Infrastructure Division. We're going to get started today. We have an agenda that's laid out. We do have a quorum here. We probably have minutes as well. It looks like we do. And if Representative Saylor would move the minutes.
I will move the minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Minutes are moved. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. We have before us several things we're going to do today. First of all, we're going to get an overview from the Telecom Alliance, Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And Randy Young, Gary Johnson are going to both be speaking today, it looks like. The CLEC overview, which had been planned, unfortunately, Ms. Almeida, her pipes burst, as the saying goes, in her house, so she was unable to make it, so she shall not be here. The next item on the agenda, Mr. Gardner, is going to provide more of an informational hearing. That's how it was posted, too, I think, in terms of the notice with respect to the bill that he has, and I look forward to hearing about that. Lastly, Representative Lesh is going to be showing up here around 9:30, and this particular item is an issue that Representative Lesh is working on with his senator, Ellen Anderson. The plan with this particular bill at this hearing today is to hear testimony, to hear a little bit about what the bill does and what folks think about it, and then we're going to lay it over probably for some more work and take a look at it again in the very near future. So that's just kind of a layout of what we're going to do this morning. So with that, I'd like to welcome Randy Young, if he's around. I found there he is. Do you want to come up to the front, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead and get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randy Young. I'm president of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. With me today is Gary Johnson, who is the COO of Paul Bunyan Rural Telephone Co-op up in the Bemidji area. We appreciate the time that you've given us today to give you a little bit of an overview of the industry, and we'll be glad to take any questions that you may have as we're going along. Just by way of background, those of you that have been here for a few years will recall that we've had two trade associations that have represented the telephone industry in the past. Minnesota Association for Rural Telephone Telecommunications, that represented the small rural companies, and MTA, that represented the rural companies and the mid-size. Just about a year ago, we merged, and we are now one organization. We hope that saves a little confusion up here when you're wondering, well, who is representing the telephone industry? It's MTA now that is representing the small and mid-sized telephone companies. To give you a little bit of a background on the companies that MTA represents, we have about 80 telcos in the state that we represent. The smallest probably has about 250 subscribers. The largest being Embark has well over 115,000. So there's a broad range of telephone companies in the state. The vast preponderance of them are small, locally owned telephone companies. About 40% of them are family-owned, about 40% are co-ops, about 60% of them are family-owned, and they range in size, as I said, from 250 subscribers up to maybe the 20,000 subscriber range. We are seeing a lot of consolidation going on in the industry as folks are retiring, selling to their neighboring telephone company and the like, and we're anticipating that we'll see more of that coming in the future. Another reason for that consolidation, quite frankly, is the expense of the technology today, the requirement for staff to be able to run not only a telephone network, but an internet network and a video network. A very small company can't afford to hire the expertise that they need often for many of those services, and they're finding if they can't find a neighboring telephone company to merge with, that when they're ready for retirement, they're merging with the telephone company quite often that's right next door. We also have about 300 vendors as members that provide services and equipment to the industry. We serve over 350 rural communities around the state, and we serve over 50% of the land mass of Minnesota. This is a rather old map. It's probably about 5 years old. But this shows the fiber network that the local telephone companies have around Minnesota. Well over 15,000 route miles of fiber. Many of those routes have got multiple strands of fiber so that there is more than adequate fiber to connect our communities to the rest of the world. I would guess all but a few of the very small communities in Minnesota have redundant routing, that is, have fiber coming into their community from two different directions, so that if there is a fiber cut, there is a self-healing redundant ring, and it'll just go out the other direction, and no one will know that there was a fiber cut. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about broadband penetration. You had a very good presentation a couple of weeks ago from Connected Nation on that. Just to say that our analysis shows that the independent telephone companies and the MTA members are around the 95% penetration rate as far as the number percentage of our customers that have got access to broadband. Many of our companies are now not only putting fiber into their backbone, but are going out into the countryside, as well as many of our companies are now actually doing fiber to the farm. I've got a cabin up in northern Minnesota served by one of the independent telephone companies, and I have fiber going to my cabin today. I can get more bandwidth and more services there, quite frankly, than I can here in the Twin Cities. But our telephone companies are really not telephone companies anymore. They're really communication companies today. The vast majority of our companies are providing both telephone service, but internet broadband service as well, and video service. In order to survive today in this marketplace, you really need to be doing the triple play, providing all three of those services, most often over the same network. The cable companies are doing the same thing. We are in the same business today, in the same marketplace. There really is no longer a cable company or a telephone company. We're all communication companies today. Just very briefly, what our legislative agenda is for this year. We have one bill that we hope will be coming through this committee in the next few weeks, and that's being carried by Representative Junkie, and that's a regulatory parity bill. As I'd indicated, we're really not in the telephone market anymore. We're in the communications market. We have competition from CLEX. We have competition from wireless. We have competition from cable companies. In a lot of cases, they are not regulated at all, or they're not regulated to the same level that we are, and we're looking for some parity in that level of regulation, particularly in two areas. One is in promotions. Right now, we have to go through a regulatory process in order to get approval to do a promotion for our customers. Many, if not all, of our competitors don't have to. That puts us at a time disadvantage when we're trying to do a promotion. Our competitors can literally think up the promotion in the shower in the morning, and by that afternoon they've got ads in the newspaper and it's on the shelf. We have to go through a regulatory process that often takes months. By the time we're in the marketplace, they figured out, looking at the PUC agenda, what our promotion is going to be, and they can beat us to the marketplace on promotion. So we're looking for some relief in the regulatory delays and that we have with promotions. And then the other one is the deregulation of business lines that are more than four lines. That was done a few years ago by the legislature for Quest in the Twin Cities and in Duluth and Rochester. We think it's worked very well. There have been no problems, and we'd like to see it expanded to include the service areas for companies that are under 500,000. We also have a couple of other bills this year, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, hopefully encouraging the use of broadband. One is expanding the tax credits that parents can have for expenses for their students to include broadband, the monthly broadband fee. And the other is a pilot project similar to one that's being done in Georgia that would provide tax incentives for employers and employees to encourage them to telecommute. And we are in the process now of working on offers, and we'll be going through the process on those two bills too. And if at any point you'd like us to come back and talk about those two bills, although they may not be bills within the jurisdiction of this committee, we'd love to come back and talk about those as well. With that, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Gary Johnson.
Well, thanks for your testimony, Mr. Young. Mr. Johnson, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman Johnson and members of the committee. I am, as Randy said, Gary Johnson. I am the Chief Operating Officer at Paul Bunyan Telephone in Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm pleased to be able to spend a couple minutes talking about our cooperative here today. I'm very proud of the work we're doing and have been doing in getting broadband out to the rural areas that we serve. And so it's a privilege to be able to share some of that story with you today. As the slide says, we were formed in 1952. Our initial formation was to get telephone service out to the areas that the larger regional operators were not serving at that time. So our traditional footprint is the area that surrounded Bemidji, the rural areas that did not have service. Again, we are a member-owned and operated cooperative. We have 9 board of directors who manage our company, who are our members and customers. We've grown to serve more than 4,000 square miles. So it's a large area of north central Minnesota, and I do have a map to illustrate that for you in just a moment. We've also grown to have 120 employees. When I started 20 years ago, I was employee number 23. So we've grown substantially, and that's happened really in terms of our employee base, in terms of the area we serve, in terms of the technology. So although I've had the same employer for all those 20 years, it's still my first job out of college. Realistically, the company I work for is nothing like the company I used to work for. It's been a tremendous transformation. And you see it throughout our industry, and we are no exception. In fact, maybe I would say we are the exception in some ways. But we've really grown in many ways, which I'll illustrate here for you. We have been, of course, an ILEC all that time. Since 1995, we are also an internet service provider. And we got into the competitive marketplace as a CLEC in 1999. Our first CLEC was actually overbuilt of Bemidji. Now, Bemidji, although our headquarters has been there some 50-some years, actually, we did not serve Bemidji at that time. That was primarily U.S. West at the time, Quest. And so that was our first facilities-based overbuild. And when I refer to our CLEC operations going forward, in all cases, it's 100% facilities-based. We do not do any resale. So we have put cable up to every customer that we are serving in a CLEC environment. And we are also, as Randy said, a triple play provider. We do offer video services over our infrastructure, and we began that process in 2001. Here's a map of where we serve. It's really grown to be a pretty sizable chunk of north central Minnesota, as you see. Everything from Leech Lake to Red Lake, virtually. Now, the color coding, the yellows and greens and so forth, that is our ILEC area. Those are the areas we serve for quite some time. The red areas are the CLEC areas I was referring to. In those areas, it is, again, 100% facilities-based, and in the majority of that red area, it is fiber to the home. All of our new construction, whether it's CLEC or ILEC upgrades, now are fiber to the home, and our video product that runs over that fiber is an IPTV solution, Internet Protocol Television. This chart just illustrates some of the growth I was talking about in terms of employees, and this really focuses on our last 10 years, the experience we've had over the last 10 years. That's really been our CLEC phase. It was a little over 10 years ago that we started that CLEC process in Bemidji and have continued to expand to other areas, as I noted on the map, including Grand Rapids, since then. That growth in our CLEC operations is really what has grown our customer base and our employee base, and primarily over the last 10 years. You'll see that our employees have grown from 40 to 120 in that time. We also have grown from 9,000 telephone subscribers to more than 27,000 telephone subscribers. And as you see there, most of that growth is CLEC subscriber growth. In terms of internet, 10 years ago we had about 2,000 customers. Now we have more than 17,000 internet customers. And finally, television. As I said, we weren't offering television 10 years ago, so that is all new growth. We have over 13,000 television subscribers. Now, one thing that we've worked very hard to do over our last decade specifically is advance our network to the point where we now offer, across our 4,000 plus square miles, we offer broadband to every subscriber in that area. So we are 100% penetrated with broadband. In terms of data services, the slowest that we offer is 1.5 megabit, and really that limitation is to about 1% of our customers. Everybody else can get something, and typically as far as 1.5 megabits. As you'll see on the bottom of that chart, that is how we're delivering video services as well, as I said. And to 99% of our customers in that 4,000 square miles territory, we are able to deliver with our infrastructure bandwidth that is sufficient to offer digital video. And digital video for us means we are sending you at least 8 megabits per second, and oftentimes it can be as high as 90 megabits per second, depending on the technology that we're using. It's a blend of ADSL, VDSL over short copper, as well as fiber to the home, as we discussed. So for the majority of that 4,000 square miles, we are providing in excess of 8 megabits per second. Now, the result of having broadband where we need it, when we need it, in our area, is best illustrated by companies like Northwest DNA. They are one of our customers. They are located about 4 miles south of Bethesda, which, if you haven't been up in our neck of the woods, literally, 4 miles south of Bethesda means you're 4 miles south of the bar and restaurant that is Bethesda, and you'd have to go another 20 miles to get to Bemidji. So for a DNA sequencing company to be located in a garage in the woods 4 miles south of Bethesda, that says something. And what it says is that we've really delivered broadband where we need it. They're a company that take in requests of for DNA sequencing. They do that work really in two ways, by using broadband and by using the shipping industry. They can do that from that location, which is where they wanted to be. So they are sending these genotypes and that type of data around the world via broadband, and receiving the specimens to do the testing on via the local shipping, FedEx and so forth. So they're a great case. We have a less than a minute long video that I'd like to show you that is the owner of Northwest DNA talking about the importance of broadband.
We have a DNA sequencing company, so we provide DNA sequencing for scientists all over the country and all over the world. And we get DNA samples, and then we read the code and return the results to them by email using broadband. We're located about 20 miles southwest of Bemidji, Minnesota, and to us it's just amazing that we have broadband and internet access. We never dreamed we'd ever get it, and we're really at the front. A lot of cities don't have it all over yet, and we're really amazed that we've been able to get it out here. Because the data files are so large, it takes a long time to transmit the files. They can be anywhere from 1 to 50 meg in size. So dialing up, it takes, you know, a long time. It takes a couple of hours to send a file back in the morning. And with broadband, with a CSL, we can do it much faster. It's just a matter of a couple of minutes.
Another success story we have in the fact that our broadband is what it is a company called EXP Solutions. They're a new company located in Bemidji. They do systems and software testing for mission-critical applications for the Department of Defense, for NASA, that type of thing. They'll try to break code, essentially, software. That's their role, is to do this high-end testing of software. They are located in various places around the country, but they have selected Bemidji as their new headquarters. And although there are many reasons for that, in fact, there's an article in your packet that was recently written in Prairie Business that talks in depth about how they selected Bemidji and why they're there. But of course, I picked a quote that talks about telecommunications as one of the reasons they're there, and that's what's on the screen here. They were very surprised, I think, to come to Bemidji, find all the resources they're looking for, and also find that we could deliver fiber to whatever location they wanted to reside. And I think that was a large part of the fact that they're there, the fact that they're successfully growing. They expect to have 36 employees in that location in the next 3 to 4 years. So it's exciting that we can attract a technology-oriented business. They are employing local engineers out of Bemidji State University who thought that if they wanted to live in Bemidji, they'd have to look for a different career. Now they're finding a career in their part of the state they want to live. And it's due in part because the telecommunications infrastructure can support the business that they're now working for. So that's exciting to see. A couple of our expansions I wanted to illustrate, and then I'll take questions. first is a very exciting project that we did, and this was in partnership with the state of Minnesota, specifically the Department of Natural Resources. So it's a great example of a public-private partnership that expanded rural broadband. In this case, Itasca State Park was looking for broadband for state services, and actually has grown now to offer Wi-Fi, access to the campgrounds, and some things that you're probably very aware of. To make that happen, they needed fiber infrastructure brought to the state park. And of course, that was done very carefully and cautiously to preserve the resources that are there in the park. So that is now up and running, and I think that project went very well. But I think even more exciting part is that because we were able to work with the state, and the state in this case, rather than doing it themselves, are our anchor tenant, commercial customer for us. In that way, we deliver the fiber. You see the map there. We went from Bemidji down on 71 to Itasca State Park. Well, if you do that, if you've driven that route, there's a small community called Lake George. It's less than 200 people live in Lake George. That's an area, much like the state park, that was doing well to even have phone service. In fact, dial-up modem service over their phone line infrastructure was iffy at best. Now that community, since we had the backbone go through the community anyway, we've built it out 100% fiber to the home. The whole exchange is now fiber to the home. So if you live in Lake George, Minnesota, you have the latest and greatest in technology. You have a fiber optic cable delivered right to your cabin, your house, or to your small business. So there's 200 residents that otherwise would not have very likely seen that type of infrastructure. If it wasn't for, really, the partnership with the state that we had and the fact that the state was our anchor tenant to be able to justify delivering that type of infrastructure to that area. And finally, I want to touch on what we're doing this year. In 2009, August of 2008, we purchased Blackjack Telephone. If I went back to that map, you'd see that Blackjack Telephone was a small independent telephone company operating, and is operating right in the middle of what was kind of Paul Bunyan's rural territory. So it made very good sense that we worked with the ownership there and were able to acquire Blackjack Telephone. But part of what came with Blackjack Telephone is an exchange called Ash River. Blackjack had acquired Ash River some years ago. And so in addition to Black Duck, you go way up by the Canadian border and you find Ash River. So now that we acquired Black Duck, we own the Ash River Exchange. There are less than 200 residents that live in that exchange. And we will be plowing a fiber. We're going to do 92 miles of construction, putting in 144 fiber strand facility all the way up to Ash River. And in that way, we'll be able to offer our broadband services, our digital television services, and of course, advanced telecom services that the business resorts that are up there. And the residents that we're hearing from are very excited to get. Again, a nice spin-off to this is a couple things. In putting that fiber facility up all the way up to the border and over to Ash River, we will go through small communities that now we will be able to serve that have been lacking that broadband infrastructure. Small towns like Big Falls, Little Fork, and of course International Falls will now have hopefully the similar experience that we saw Lake George have, where when you have the anchors backbone get put through, then there is justification for building that facility out to those rural residents. Another interesting thing about Ash River is that is the future home of the Nova Neutrino Project. If you've been following that, that's a very scientific facility that they expect to build this year. The Department of Energy is involved, the University of Minnesota is involved. And our fiber facility will deliver, or at least will have the capacity to deliver, whatever extreme amounts of bandwidth that high-tech scientific research facility will demand. It will be their far-end detector, and with that will come a lot of data that will be streaming to their other facilities that are all part of that Nova project. So we see the fiber facility not just good for the 200 subscribers that we are now their service provider, but really the communities along the way. And specifically, we hope to work with the Nova project and deliver fiber facility right up to their detector and handle their extreme amounts of bandwidth we expect that they'll need to send. And I think that's it. I have my contact information there, and I certainly welcome your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony. One question I have for you. Did you seek or obtain assistance from the Department of Agriculture for some of your broadband work? Excuse me.
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Can you say a little bit about what that entails?
Sure. We are a recipient of their broadband loan program. We've made good use of that. It's a low-interest loan program that they have had for a few years now. And really the goals of that program, as we understand it, are to do exactly what we're doing, which is deliver broadband to rural areas that otherwise did not have that. So, yeah, we're a large recipient of the Rural Development's broadband loan program.
And do you have any plans or intentions with respect to the federal stimulus opportunities through RUS, the Rural Utility Service, or the other option for broadband deployment?
Yes, we do. We have identified some projects, some shovel-ready projects that we, in fact, work with Randy to hopefully submit through both those channels, and would very much like to see some of the stimulus money be used in this way where we can further expand a fiber-to-the-home network to rural areas that are underserved.
Mr. Chair, to expand on that a little bit, as you and the chair of the Senate committee had requested of the Broadband Task Force to compile a list of shovel-ready broadband projects. We've done that for our membership, and we've got about 20 companies with about 70 projects that would benefit about 75 rural communities, totaling about $150 million of broadband construction that we're ready to go with this spring. Unfortunately, what we're understanding from the federal stimulus package is by the time the federal agencies get their rules ready and the application process, it'll probably be fall. So we may not be able to use that money this year, but hopefully the applications will be able to be in and we'll be able to do it for next construction season in 2010.
Very good. Members, we will be talking a little bit more in depth at some point about the federal stimulus monies and the impact for telecommunications issues here in the state of Minnesota. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stole my questions. I was going to ask the same thing about federal programs and then the stimulus, but I'll ask another one for Mr. Johnson. Are you running fiber anywhere right now where you don't have an anchor tenant, somebody to make it worthwhile, so to speak?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, in some ways, the development, the 92 miles of construction we'll do this year up to International Falls, actually, we do not have an anchor tenant there. Really, our anchor tenant are 120 to 200 subscribers that we have in Ash River. That's the impetus to do that. So in that particular case, we don't have signed contracts. I should say we do have some, but not to the degree where, as in Itasca State Park, we had the DNR that was most definitely our anchor tenant. Now, at the same time, I haven't talked about it much, but in our ILEC areas, we are also doing a very aggressive rebuild of our network to do fiber to the home there. So we are doing a lot of work that it isn't just for, large customers or anchor tenants.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johnson. One of the things I was kind of wondering is, you're a nice guy, but I don't think you're doing this out of the goodness of your heart. Go 92 miles running fiber to 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the numbers work out in that, but I'm glad you're doing it. I think it's great. So, thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer, good question.
No. I did not, but Mr. Chairman, since you asked, I was listening to some of these questions out here. It sounds like your plans for the future are pretty ambitious, and so it would be important to know what you've already had in mind, but what do you see for the future in regards, we had testimony here that there's the MAC things and other, there's some pretty progressive things we've heard. Do you have some of those in mind as well?
Mr.
Johnson?
Yeah, Representative Kiffmeyer. Yes, we do. We're looking at all technologies. Certainly we're focusing on our fiber infrastructure. We think that the capacity of fiber is unmatched in any other technology, and that's very important to get that out there, probably more so than anything else we're doing. But having said that, we are certainly watching the wireless industry to see how that can augment our service territory, whether it's for voice or mobile data applications. We have been a participant in the 700 megahertz auction, so we do own spectrum across all of that area that was on that map, in hopes that we can blend our fiber infrastructure with mobile
technologies like 700 megahertz and really offer the complete package to those areas that today don't get those. So.
Okay, thank you.
So good. Representative Sarah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to echo so many of the things that Mr. Johnson said, because I do represent much of the area that that he provides services to, or Paul Runyon does. I guess I can just have people look back at the map that shows that kind of tan area right underneath Lake George. And those are the people I'm always talking about when you hear me complaining about service, because it is certainly not Paul Runyon. Paul Runyon does a fantastic job. And so many other businesses just south of the line or just outside of their area are constantly raising the issue of, you know, how they cannot expand their businesses because they don't have these options. And I would just say it's such a clear-cut example of how much difference good broadband technology makes in our area. You know, to have, you know, the folks just south of Bethesda, that really is out in the woods. I drive there a lot. You would never suspect that there would be a business with those capabilities, and it certainly would not be there without the opportunities afforded us by Paul Runyon. So it makes all the difference in the world to our rural areas, and, you know, not just rural areas. It makes all the difference everywhere. But I just wanted to say thank you to him for coming down and to just reiterate that it's truly, truly important. So at any rate, thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony this morning. Most appreciated, and we know where you are, so we look forward to continue working with you through the committee here. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for coming down in particular. Representative Gardner.
Good morning.
Welcome, Representative Gardner. I think what we're looking for is kind of a brief overview of the bill and explanation of what it does. And it appears there's a couple people are going to testify as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you'd like to be done by 9:30, so Representative Lesh could do his thing.
Well done. Yes.
Maybe I could have some of the testifiers get plugged in while we're waiting, so that can be ready to go. Good morning, Mr. Chair. House File 170 is here just for informational purposes only. For some of you who don't know, I worked in the recycling industry for about 10 years before I came to the legislature. There actually is a statute related to phone book recycling, which has been kind of problematic in recent years because it's a little vague in how it's written. That's sort of how I got to know this issue a little bit, but as many of us have been campaigning around the state, going door to door during the fall and the summer, you keep running into people and they say, "Oh, hi, Paul, nice to see you. Oh, look, there's another phone book on my stoop." People have said, "Boy, this is really starting to get annoying." What I had in a larger solid waste reform bill last year was what I thought was a nice little non-controversial provision that would allow consumers to opt out of getting a telephone directory if they didn't want one. And that turned out to be the biggest lightning rod in the whole bill. But since that time, I've actually had a chance to meet with the industry. I did create a standalone bill that would allow consumers to opt out of receiving a phone directory if they don't want one. I've learned a lot about how the printing industry works. It's been very helpful. But for whatever reason, Mr. Chair and members, this seems, in this deficit year, I've had more phone calls, emails, media calls about this bill more than anything else I've ever worked on, including stuff that will actually save the budget, save some money in the budget. And I can't seem to stop it. I think maybe a lot of editors and reporters are younger than me and are used to using Blackberries and computers and not using a phone book. I still want one, personally, but I can't seem to stop it now. But in the interest of focusing on what's really important this year, which is the deficit creating jobs, is either raising revenue or saving state money, I thought I would not take up a whole lot of time in committees this year to focus on this issue. So I really want to have an informational hearing. There are guests here today from the Yellow Pages Association, and Jax have actually done some things that I think would meet the needs of consumers without legislation, and I think that's probably a good thing. Dex has actually been a leader here in allowing consumers not only to opt out of getting a telephone directory if they don't want one, but ordering additional directories if they want one. And they've actually had a site that's been up and running. And I really wanted to have this hearing also to give them the chance to speak. I've been saving, you know, for months. All my phone books are under here, under the desk, but I think in the interest of time, I won't bring them out for a dramatic effect. Yeah. They're really helping keep my handier. Now I can recycle them. But in any case, the whole process has been very helpful. Having a bill out there has allowed some stakeholders to chip in and point out issues that are important to them. I talked to the Telecom Alliance yesterday, and they say, well, we don't really do a lot of drop-off stuff, or if we do, it's done by nonprofit groups, and our directories are rather small in volume and size, and there are a few of them, and we just send them out by mail. And so that sort of brings a different dynamic into it. Here in the Metro, of course, we have sometimes half a dozen very thick books landed on our desk. I was going to also point out that the Minnesota rules actually requires that your phone company deliver essentially a white page, a residential directory, to you unless you specifically want to opt out. So that kind of complicates things. I've also met with the Multi-Housing Association, which is here today. Apartment building owners actually have had a lot of problems where they'll have a pallet of phone books dropped off in the areas where they don't have a lot of space anyway, and these 20-somethings who live in their buildings just kind of go by and go, and look at that as kind of a fossil, the phone book, and go upstairs and use their iPhone to, you know, call for pizza. So there are some issues to be worked out there. But today I wanted to really have an informational hearing so that people could see that we are interested in dealing with what is a consumer annoyance in some place, but we also want to give consumers choice. And two people have come. They've flown in yesterday's weather to Minneapolis, St. Paul, sometimes directly, sometimes not, to talk about some of the things the industry is doing. And I'm hoping that there will be some awareness on your part and your constituents to see that consumers can actually opt out now if they want to, and you'll find out the information resources to do that now. So today I've got Amy Healy from the Yellow Pages Association, as well as Maggie Stonecipher from R.H. Donnelly, which is the publisher for Dex, which is the directory provider for Quest. I don't know how they couldn't all work it all out. So you have to have a couple layers there. But one came from New Jersey, and another one from Kansas City, I think, via Sioux Falls today. So I'd like to turn it over to them, and they can run you through a little demo of what they've got.
Welcome to the committee, and Ms. Healy, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah, if you'd identify yourself for the record, then go ahead.
Certainly. My name is Amy Healy. I'm Director of Public Policy for the Yellow Pages Association. Thank you, Chairman.
We're not on TV, but I'll just... That's just my house.
Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Hoppe, and members of the Telecommunications Regulation and Infrastructure Division Subcommittee. YPA is the largest trade association representing directory publishers and suppliers in the United States. Association members include Yellow Pages publishers, who produce products that account for almost 90% of Yellow Pages revenue generated in the United States and Canada. Members also include the industry's national and local sales force and associate members, a group of industry stakeholders that include Yellow Pages advertisers, suppliers, and vendors such as printing and paper companies. The association has members in 29 countries. On behalf of its members, YPA respectfully opposes Representative Gardner's bill. Having said that, I'm here to let you know that we have taken this issue very seriously, and we thank Representative Gardner for continuing to hear us out on this issue. I'd like to share with you what we have done to date to address the concerns raised by Representative Gardner and others. For nearly 130 years, the Yellow Pages industry has a shared commitment to provide quick and accurate local search information for millions of our small business advertisers and our millions of consumers. As an active member of local communities across the country, our members also share a commitment to bringing environmental, social, and economic benefits to the places where they work and live. This bill requires any person publishing a directory in the state of Minnesota to make available to consumers the option to decline delivery, to maintain a database of those individuals, and to print the opt-out information on the cover of their directories. Yellow Pages publishers want their products to be welcome into people's homes, and they already have opt-out systems in place to allow the customers to choose how many directories they'd like or none at all. Our members are continually are committed to providing customers a choice as to the number of directories they receive. Delivering a directory to a customer that doesn't want one provides no value to the advertiser, to the directory publisher, and certainly to the consumer. In 2008, three other states, in addition to Minnesota, considered directory opt-out legislation. Legislators were not motivated to move the legislation forward once they were made aware of the self-regulatory efforts of the industry, the reliance of millions of small businesses on directory advertising to grow their business, and the thousands of good local jobs provided by the directory publishing industry and its suppliers. It's also important to note that Yellow Pages advertising is sold on usage, not circulation. As part of the industry's commitment to consumer choice in the environment, YPA is engaged in an aggressive environmental stewardship program that includes the following. Throughout 2007, YPA worked with the Association of Directory Publishers, a trade association representing independent or non-telco affiliated publishers, to draft joint environmental guidelines for the Yellow Pages industry. The guidelines, adopted by the boards of both YPA and ADP, commit all signatories to implement directory distribution policies that allow people to choose not to receive a Yellow Pages directory. In addition to source reduction, the guidelines also focus on dedicating resources to local recycling efforts and a commitment to environmentally sound manufacturing practices, using soy and vegetable-based inks instead of petroleum and so forth. Publishers representing well over 90% of U.S. distribution are committed to the guidelines. For more information, please visit www.yellowisgreen.org. Consumer choice. YPA has also been working with national environmental and government groups such as the Product Stewardship Institute, a national environmental organization representing approximately 90 state, local, and private environmental groups, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and several state government agencies, including the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We've been working with this group on the industry's consumer choice program. One achievement of that collaboration has been the creation and launch of the industry's website, yellowpagesoptout.com. This site allows the consumer to input their zip code and find out the opt-out information for the publishers serving their area. YPA continues to work with our environmental and government partners on enhancements to the industry's consumer choice program. On recycling, YPA members commit large amounts of funding to recycling efforts. As a result, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that Yellow Pages directories represent just 0.3% of the municipal solid waste stream. Newspapers and standard mail, on the other hand, make up 24 times that amount, 4.9% and 2.4% respectively. The YPA and its members are H. Donnelly, AT&T Yellow Pages, and R.R. Donnelly, the major printer, among others such as Waste Management, were founding members of the Recycle As You Shop program. RAISE was launched in the fall of 2008 and is a recycling program which was set up to encourage members and small businesses to be responsible stewards of the environment by dropping off the phone directories and other paper recyclables at Office Depot stores in Maryland. We hope to grow the RAISE program when the price of waste paper recovers. For more information about the RAISE program, please visit recycleasyoushop.com. Finally, it's important to note that the fact is people do use the printed Yellow Pages product. Our research shows that adults referenced the printed Yellow Pages approximately 13.4 billion times in 2007, with nearly half of all adults referencing the print product on a weekly basis. Yellow Pages products also continue to provide a high return on investment for advertisers. Despite this reliance on directory products by consumers and small businesses, our members certainly don't want to give a directory to a person that doesn't want one. The Yellow Pages industry will continue to work with government agencies and environmental groups to improve the manner in which it provides local search information. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I look forward to any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Healy. Ms. Seifer, did you want to provide some testimony? Just identify yourself, please.
Sure, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'm Maggie Stone Seifer. I am the ADP for Print and Delivery Services for R.H. Donnelly, the publisher of DEX. In early 2007, R.H. Donnelly recognized this trend to consumers wanting choice in the print product that they received at their directory door. Our CEO, Dave Swanson, chartered a dedicated team in July 2007 to develop our strategies and develop a program in order to address consumers' concerns and to give them choice. And just under 10 months, we launched a comprehensive program, being the first publisher to lead the industry in this initiative. This program is called Select Your Decks. For us, maintaining unique customer information at the directory delivery address level has been part of our processes since the early 90s. Almost 35% of our consumers actually request additional directories. And for that reason, we maintain individual information and preferences so that we can honor those requests. Approximately every 3 to 4 years, we reset our database to 1 in order to perform hygiene, because this is a low-impact product. And in September 2007, we reset all 35 million customers in our delivery database to 1 in order to clean up our database and make sure we had accurate records. Since that time, since September 2007, we are back up over 30% of consumers requesting additional directories. I offer this testimony to support what Amy stated in terms of this product is not dead. Consumers do rely on this product, as do small and medium-sized advertisers. But the shift to Select Your Dex. Select Your Dex is an easy-to-use website that we dedicated to consumers providing their choice. We wanted to make it short, simple, easy to use. We wanted the experience to be less than 2.5 minutes, so that not to make this laborious for consumers to express their choice. From our homepage, dexknows.com, which we recently launched our new version this week, so I'm proud to say it's a more robust local search engine, from the bottom of that page, there is a footer link for Select Your Dex. So it briefly tells the consumer what Select Your Dex is and asks them to put in their zip code. Since I'm a little bit nervous, I'm going to use my mother's zip code, since I know that and I know what book she's entitled to. My mother lives in Naples, Florida, and she receives the Embark branded Dex telephone directories. The first page is intended to be just a short informational page that pops up a visual of the directories that she receives and tells her what those directories are. There's a lot of consumer confusion around all these different telephone directories, from Yellow Book, from Dex, from other publishers. So we wanted to make it very clear to the consumer what are the Dex products that we offer in her area. We also offer at the bottom a phone number for those consumers that are not as web savvy, so that they can call and talk with a personal representative. This is a dedicated phone number to Select Your Dex with the rep specially trained to handle these types of calls. The next page shows my mother what directory she actually receives at her address. She receives 4 directories from Dex, and she has the ability to customize that order. You can see on the right-hand side of the page where it instructs basic information so that we can change her information in our delivery database and maintain that going forward, and then that she can select 0 to 3 each of the directories that she receives in her area. So she's allowed to customize her product. In her area, we have unique yellow pages, a unique white pages, a community directory, and then our smaller plus directory. So if a consumer likes the little book but doesn't want to use the big book, they can order 3 of the plus directories and 0 of the big book. If they don't want the white pages but they want everything else, they can just order the other books and put 0 for the white pages. We will then customize what comes to her door every year when we deliver that directory. We also have provided a link to the YPA site, yellowpagesoptout.com. And again, this is a zip code-based system that Amy mentioned earlier. And a consumer can go in, put in their zip code, and it will also tell my mother all the other publishers in her area and how she may contact them as well. So while Dex is the first publisher to offer our own unique site, we also have worked very closely with YPA to be a leader within the industry, pushing this issue with our peer publishers so that consumers can find this information for all publishers. So very simply, this order gets placed. She will receive an email confirmation back confirming the order, and then that will be in her record, and we will adhere to that request going forward. If a consumer has requested zero directories from us at the time of initial delivery, we want to confirm that information because consumers do move. We do have wireless-only consumers that don't get new connects through the local telephone company. There may be turnover in that residence, and so we will use a door hanger to the door to confirm their order, let them know that we have got their order, we're not delivering any directories to them, and that if they would like to revise that order or change it in any way, how they can do that. And it also provides information on how to use DexKnows.com as their local search engine. With this process, it has been live since May 2008. From the database side, it's working very effectively. We are now aggressively working to make sure we can make this happen on the street. That is the next major step for us. We employ thousands of individuals to deliver telephone directories throughout our 28 states every year, every day. And those individuals get a set of instructions, and we train them, and we hope to get them to honor those requests. And we are putting processes in place in order to help us do that. In the upcoming Minneapolis delivery, which will be starting in just a few months, we are doing a couple of things different to try and make sure we can execute this. I will actually have team members from my in the area every single week. We will be driving routes. We will be doing education, re-education on any problems that we see. We're going to work very closely with the multi-unit managers and condo associations, because those are a big challenge for us. If we have an individual in a multi-unit high-rise, I like to say also I'm responsible for the delivery of the Chicago market, I'm never going to get a book to Oprah Winfrey's front door. It's just not going to happen. But she may have five other people in her building that have opted out of our product. So we'll work with those building managers to get the right number into those common areas, but then also come pick those up when the consumers have had an opportunity to pick them up and then get them out of there. So we will be doing the same in Minneapolis and in all of our initial deliveries across the 28 states, working very carefully with those multi-unit residences to try and improve the process, because that's going to be one of our biggest weaknesses as we try to operationalize this. Thank you for this opportunity.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Seifer. Questions, members? Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I can just picture at the Gardner House right now, Representative Gardner's wife saying, why can't I find a phone box?
What are those things?
And then I had a question from Ms. Stonecycle. The question I had about the decks where people can decide which books they want, what kind of success have you had industry-wide with, you know, Ed's phone book delivery and Bob's phone book delivery and everybody else doing the same kind of a similar program, you know, that you're already doing?
Chairman, I'm sorry if I violate any protocols. It's my first hearing testimony, so...
Forgiven.
Okay, thank you.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
We are working very closely with YPA and our peer publishers to help them, to educate them, to offer assistance in what we've done and how quickly we've been able to get it up and running. The YPA site being zip code based is not entirely a coincidence. We did not make any of our processes proprietary or trademarked or branded. I have been available for consultation to other publishers on how to make this work. And so we will continue to be a leader to try and get the industry all to the same point.
I'm happy.
Just a quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. How are they doing? Are people receptive to following what you're doing? Are the other publishers or?
Actually, I'll defer that to Amy because she works with them and can speak on their behalf where I cannot.
See, now I'm violating protocol. Asking the wrong person.
Ms. Hu?
Thank you, Kim. Absolutely. I think you'll find certainly R.H. Donnelly is the industry leader. They're the largest publisher in the state of Minnesota, but we have other large members as well that have taken cues from R.H. Donnelly and also have done some of their own things. In Minnesota, you have Verizon Yellow Pages published by IDARC Media, as well as Yellow Book are the other two largest publishers. I can tell you that Yellow Book and April has a national rollout combining a print, online, and a telephone opt-out number. So when you call 1-800-YD-YELLOW, you'll actually have a prompt that says to opt out or to stop receiving directory. So it will be very clear, and they're doing that in conjunction with their print rollouts and online components as well. So certainly RH Donnelly has been the leader, and we've been, as an association, promoting them and their efforts. It's actually been good for others to see them and to try to catch up, because our customers, our members, believe this is a customer service issue. They want to be responsive to their customers. And I think you'll see IDARC also has their 1-800 numbers out in Minnesota as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question is for Ms. Stone-Cypher. I was just wondering, and maybe you said this and I missed it, but the phone service that you have for opt-out for people that aren't so much into the web, is that a 24/7, or is that just during certain working times that they will be able to access that?
Chairman, Representative, that is a call center service based out of Nebraska, and it is not 24 hours, but it is to reflect the business hours from east to west coast. So it operates from 8 a.m. Through, I believe, 6:30 p.m. Central Time.
Okay. And I just had a follow-up for wanting you to expand a little bit on your door hanger program. How does that work in areas of, shall we say, less concentration of homes or places?
Ms. Pfeiffer?
The door hanger program is for our hand-delivered markets. There are quite a few markets in Minnesota that are mailed, and consumers in mailed markets can certainly contact us to opt out of receiving the directory. We're not seeing that trend. We're seeing this is much more an urban issue, where individuals such as Representative Gardner get a stack like that as opposed to one smaller book for their market. So they certainly can, but it's not a trend that we're seeing in our rural markets.
Mr. Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Representative Gardner. On the actual language of the bill, and any one of the three of you could maybe answer this, but I just need a little bit more information where it says, deliver means to physically bring to a resident by personal delivery, but does not include the UPS, commercial courier, package delivery, and I'm thinking, okay, we got a huge exception there for this whole thing, and maybe I'm sure in this language can maybe explain a little bit more what's the purpose of not including some of these other entities and only including physically delivering.
Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, if we were planning to vote on this and go through the process, I based on what I heard yesterday from the Telecom Alliance about the mailing system, I probably would have changed that, but again, I'm sort of interested in finding ways to balance the budget and spending our time on that rather than wordsmithing this. If we were going all the way with it somehow, or if the industry was a group of scofflaws that needed reining in, then I'd probably try and fix that. But I appreciate the comments, and I still have this bill next year, so just in case, I'll make a note of it. So.
That's it, Willie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gardner. I think your bill is a good idea. I just I have some concerns about your enforcement part of it, and you know, I grew up in the newspaper business, and I think my family serves your area, but for many of my years I was involved with circulation, and the reality is, you know, sometimes people get papers that they're not, don't necessarily want, or if they're on vacation, they ask to stop, and sometimes there's, you know, you have a carrier that makes a mistake, or they have a friend that's doing their route, they're on vacation, there's all sorts of variables, and, you know, they might find that they make a mistake. Now, I personally, I think the idea is good, but I just find a $500, for each violation, just to be pretty hardcore for my taste, and you know, I just think that encouraging them, you know, to do the right thing and to do what you're asking probably is a better way than the fine. Perhaps you're arguing that it won't work, you know, or they won't take it serious, but I would hope that they would. And but I'm just really uncomfortable with the enforcement part of it. Would you be willing to remove that part of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I'm not actually asking for any action on the bill today. I'm just having that there. But lines 2.22 and 2.23 do allow as a defense that the delivery of the directive was done in error. I'm not an attorney, and I would sort of have to consult with the civil justice folks to figure out, you know, whether that's the right way to go. And I'm, you know, once we get through the deficit situation or if we really need to go forward this next year, I would be happy to talk with you about that. May I say the Shoreview Ordinary Hills Bulletin is a fine, fine paper. But actually, this is something I thought about also is, you know, the policy at the corporate level can be great, but the actual execution of it, whether you're talking about phone directories or something else completely, is sort of where the rubber meets the road. And there are a lot of people who are families, mom and dad are driving the car, and the kids are going out and dropping off the directories down the street. And you've got Lions Clubs and fire departments who use these as sometimes as a fundraiser for community papers. And I can see the complexity here of a major metropolitan area getting directories, for example, with DEX, where, you know, it is going to take a few cycles to sort of figure out how the delivery system is going to work. Representative Saylor and I worked in recycling for many years, and trying to educate people to do something over a wide area at every home is hard, and there's a lot of links in the chain. So that was one of the reasons that I just wanted to do an informational hearing is to really bring people to the table, bring the issue to the table, get stakeholders talking. And I've had people come and talk to me about their ideas that would not have unless there was a bill on the table. So the enforcement part of it, I certainly am interested in talking with folks about. Mr. Stonecipher talked about what DEX is going to do this spring. They were actually pushing advertising their selected DEX site earlier this winter, so they had the data in time for the May delivery in the West Metro, in Minneapolis area, in the suburbs there, so they could get it out. And she says they're going to have people actually monitoring to make sure people who said they wanted to opt out actually don't get a directory. And if that doesn't work, I think all of us are going to get some calls from people just saying, you know, I'm throwing down the gauntlet, and that's it. But I'd like to see how it goes. But Representative Lesh is looking over my shoulder, so I'm going to leave it there.
A good segue for any concluding comments you want to make, Representative Gardner?
No, Mr. Chair, I just want to say I personally want a phone book. I just don't want five, and I like the idea of having choice. And so I encourage the industry to keep doing what they're doing, and we'll see how it goes.
Very good. Thank you, testifiers in particular, for coming down and sharing us this information. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say they can't tell me how many people have opted out because it's a secret. So.
All right.
Still a competitive.
We'll work on that.
Three.
Representative Lesh, come on down and we'll get started on House File 854. Representative Lesh, just for your information, I did inform folks here and members that we're going to lay this matter over and hear some testimony here from you what the bill is about and so forth. So with that, I'm going to move that House File 854 come before the committee. And Representative Lesh, you want to present what the bill is about and what it entails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 854 is a constituent bill. A constituent of mine, Greg Martinson, came forward and brought this bill. He had his son, who was in seventh grade, lose a cell phone at Valley Fair, and as seventh grade boys are wont to do sometimes, neglected to mention it to dad, and 7 months later they ended up with a $1,500 phone bill. This was of great concern. I can tell you that I have similar concerns. I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I got this great new iPhone now, which is mostly neat. With a few problems, but I gave one of my old phones to my daughter. I gave the other one to John Reich, so John Reich has my other one. But my daughter got my other Palm Trio. And, you know, she's eight, and I wonder, you know, she's very responsible with it, but I just wait for the day when she's going to forget to mention that she left it in the backpack, that she left at school, and the phone calls got racked up, and I end up with a very large phone bill. This bill ensures that liability is limited to $50 sets a 60-day timeline. I understand some of the providers are concerned with that timeline. However, I think it's kind of reasonable to the extent that, you know, once the phone numbers start getting called, they won't even go onto the statement until a month later, and then 30 days after that, you know, you're expected to pay it. So I don't even know if I have to pay for the bill when I'm not even going to look at it until the point when I have to pay it, when that's about 60 days out. So it could potentially even perhaps should be longer. That said, we are going to work out some details. I have had several members of the industry in my office discussing it. They seem like very nice, reasonable people, and I'm sure we can work out some kind of compromise on this. But other than that, I would stand for questions, or you could take some of the other testifiers.
Representative Jenkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be more worried about Mr. Wright with your phone than your daughter.
Good point.
Yeah. My question is, when your friend got the phone bill for $1,500, called the phone company, did they refuse to reverse the charges?
Okay, well, this is
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie. There was some question about this. I had brief conversations with my constituent yesterday. There was a hearing in the Senate yesterday. Apparently, there's some dispute about what exactly went down. I know that there was an initial amount, a large amount, that was offered to be reimbursed or refunded. I don't know really how many hoops he had to jump through in order to get that. I know my own experience with dealing with phone bills at times. I have to go through voicemail menus half a dozen different times. You get the wrong person and they refer you to someone else, and I really kind of resent having to be put through the ringer, and I don't know what he had to do in order to get that initial amount refunded, but I think they did offer an initial amount refunded, but there was still several hundred dollars outstanding that he disagreed with, which was the subject of the dispute.
All right, Mr. Chair, that's important information, I think, and that's probably what we're going to hear from the folks in the audience, I'm guessing, but I haven't typically had a problem, but again, a hint to legislators, if you ever have a problem with your phone or cell phone, just call the lobbyist.
What's going to happen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Junkie. I guess, Representative Lesh, how widespread is this problem? I mean, is this, you know, one guy whose kid lost his phone at Valley Fair, or is it happening to, you know, two households on every block?
Well, Tim, Representative Hoppe, I think the correct answer is two households on every block. No, I'm kidding. I don't really know. I think, a fairness issue. I mean, I know that if I was put in that situation, I would want to make sure that the law protected me as a consumer, first and foremost, with obviously reasonable safeguards for the carrier. But when you're, you know, it's like trying to fight City Hall. You're not trying to fight City Hall anymore because the phone company's a lot bigger than City Hall. I'd like
necessarily
in some cases I'd like the law to make sure that it protects me in the first place. I honestly don't know. I know it's a constituent bill. I heard from a constituent, so that's why I'm bringing it forward.
Representative Kiffmeyer, and then we'll hear from our testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, out of respect for our testifiers, I would rather allow them to come forward first because they might answer my question.
Oh, very good. Ms. Paris and Bob Bass, you want to both come on down and have a seat? Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Julie Parrish with Larkin Hoffman Attorneys. I'm here today representing T-Mobile. T-Mobile is the carrier that Mr. Wes is referring to that had an issue with his constituent, Mr. Martinson, and we heard testimony from him yesterday in the Senate Commerce Committee. I just want to provide a little insight into how T-Mobile handled that situation. Mr. Martinson activated the account in question on August 1st of 2007. He reported that the phone was lost on August 12th of 2007 and then called again on the 17th and reinstated the service. On September 14th of 07, he called back again and said the phone was lost. At some point, he discussed the fact that he reinstated the phone not knowing where the phone was, that he thought it was lost in his home, but had reinstated the service regardless. So T-Mobile felt that Mr. Martinson did have some responsibility to the phone company, to T-Mobile, and to the bill. They did raise over $1,000 worth of his charges. So $1,000.26 of charges were erased from his bill. He was left with between $200 and $300. That amount was unclear yesterday in the testimony. We did credit about 80% of his bill and gave him the benefit of the doubt that the phone was lost, even though he reactivated his service. I think that our main concern with the language in the bill is that we might be left not being allowed to give consumers the benefit of the doubt in these situations if liability is limited to $50. We would have to prove that the charges themselves were unauthorized, and I think it would create a situation where we would be put in a position where we'd be looking at a consumer, especially if they have up to 90 days to report that their phone was lost or stolen, that there might be a fraud situation that's created here if they have that amount of time to come forward and say their phone was lost. Most of us know when our phone is lost or stolen, and as Representative West talked about, there are situations, especially with children, where situations do happen, and we deal with those on a case-by-case basis. If we're put into this box, I think we're a little bit concerned that we'll be forced to take a much harder look at people's phone bills and their usage activity and be kind of put in that position where we're not quite so quick to give someone the benefit of the doubt in this situation.
Very good. Mr. Bass, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Bob Bass, and I'm the president of AT&T in Minnesota. And I'm here today on behalf of the 2,300 employees we have here in Minnesota. And we appreciate the opportunity to participate in the hearing today on House File 854. We did speak with Representative Lesch a couple days ago, and we have been speaking with Senator Anderson in the Senate as well. And there's no question that both of them have a deep passion for their consumers in District 66, and we applaud those efforts to try and find protection for wireless consumers. However, I would respectfully submit from AT&T that we feel that this legislation isn't necessary, that our current policies and practices provide ample protections for consumers, because it's in our best interest to handle the issue of a lost or stolen phone or an unauthorized charge in a way that's satisfactory for consumers. We're in a hyper-competitive industry, and if we don't take care of a customer, someone else will. With local number portability, people can frequently move if they're not happy with their experience. With the issues of lost or stolen phones, AT&T's policy is if your phone is lost or stolen, we ask that you immediately notify us. And that you can either call a customer care center or you can notify us via the Internet. We then will immediately deactivate or suspend that service. We then let the customer know that they are no longer liable for any subsequent charges to that device. We then ask them to look at their bill when they receive their next bill and look at the period of time around when they thought that phone was lost or stolen. And we want to know if there's charges on there that don't look right. Because if there are, we want them to contact us, and we'll look at those and reverse those charges, because we don't want to charge customers for phone calls that they didn't make. We're very, it's erring on the side of the consumer is not the right phrase, but if there is a closeness issue, we like to side with the customer. Again, it's a competitiveness issue. It's about us taking care of our customers. With respect to unauthorized charges, again, we ask our customers to look at their bills every month. Look at those bills for the charges. Make sure those are the calls they made. And if there are charges on those bills, we want them to contact us. And we give our customers up to 100 days to notify us of a dispute on a charge on their bill. And if, for whatever reason, we can't resolve that dispute to their satisfaction, we offer arbitration to our customers to resolve that dispute. So we think those are ample protections, both on the issue of a lost or stolen phone, and then on the issue of unauthorized charges. Ms. Paris mentioned briefly that subdivision one of this bill, we believe it could lead to criminal behavior, because what could happen is if somebody had 60 days to report a lost or stolen phone, you can imagine the charges that could be run up. At the same time, it could the behavior it would incent could be a customer decides to make a lot of calls, has a bad month financially, and then they can decide to say that their phone's been lost or stolen. Unfortunately, if this bill were to go through like that, that type of behavior would be very costly. And those costs will be borne by the honest Minnesotans who go out and play by the rules, pay their bills, and do the things that they should do. So we feel that that is a problem as well. With respect for your time, I won't go on much longer, but I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today in front of the committee. The good news is the passion and concern that Representative Lesch and Senator Anderson have for their constituents is shared by all of us. We provide ample protections, as you've heard, on our policies, and our policies are pretty consistent for the other carriers as well. But in this case, whether it's the issue of a lost or stolen phone or an unauthorized charge, we think consumers are in pretty good shape right now. And with that, I'll thank you, and if there's any questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Baxter. Testimony. I see we have one other gentleman here I've met before, but I can't remember
his
name.
Michael McDermott. Mr. Chairman, how are you?
Very good.
May I?
Yep. Please, again, identify yourself just for the record.
Yes, sir. Chairman, my name is Michael McDermott. I'm the Executive Director of State Public Policy for Verizon Wireless. It's good to be back before the committee again. Last time I was here, I think we had a blizzard of about 20 inches, so fortunately we were able to cut that down by a few yesterday. I'll keep my comments brief regarding the bill, but before I address Verizon Wireless's concerns, I'd like to update you on some positive changes. My counterpart, Mr. Bass, likens it to a commercial, so I'll try to run through this, but I think it's important to lay the benchmark of what Verizon's done in the state in the last year since I last spoke before the committee. Over the last 12 months, we've acquired two wireless entities, Rural Cellular Corporation, known as RCC, as well as Altel Wireless. Integration should be completed by the third quarter of this year. The RCC integration is nearly completed. We are an undeniable economic engine in the state of Minnesota. In 2008 alone, we spent $86 million to upgrade our network, to bring new cell sites on, to expand our licensed area, and bring data speeds, broadband data, to all corners of the state where we have a licensed spectrum. We've spent over $500 million in the last 8 years alone to improve our network here in Minnesota. And we spend an additional $500 million a year with Minnesota-based companies like 3M and Target on the large side, but also small businesses like KGP, a women-owned enterprise in Faribault. And we now are proud to say that we serve over 83 million customers nationally. Regarding the bill, Mr. Chairman, while it's well-intended, we feel very strongly that the bill is not necessary. In Subdivision 1, by creating a dollar amount in which the carriers must limit the customer's exposure to fraudulent charges, violates Section 332 of the Federal Telecom Act, 332C specifically. It's not that the fraudulent charges that are at issue, it's the fact that the legislature is stipulating how much wireless carriers must charge customers under a specific circumstance. And that is where Section 332C of the Federal Act is violated. The author attempts to bridge fraudulent cell phone charges to credit card fraud laws, and they're not compatible. Again, as I mentioned, this bill is not necessary. Verizon Wireless has put in place several stopgap measures that put usage controls on their child's usage in the parent's hands. If a child is prone to losing the phone, the parent can dial up or down the number of minutes that can be used during the billing cycle. Parents can set a schedule on when the phone can be used, and they can set parameters on who can call the phone and what numbers the phone can dial. In addition, as Mr. Bass suggested regarding AT&T, Verizon Wireless has a very liberal policy that encourages customers to contact us immediately when they are aware that their phone has been lost or stolen. This proposal will incentivize bad behavior in which a customer merely has to notify the carrier that the phone was lost or stolen and that the carrier would have to hold the customer to a $50 cap, even though they've used their phone to rack up large bills. In the end, this proposal will raise the cost of service and remove any good faith relationship between the carrier and the customer. And I'll wrap by reading verbatim what our contract reads regarding the issue of lost and stolen phones. It's in the contract that every customer gets when they sign up. If your wireless phone is lost or stolen, it is very important that you notify us immediately for your own protection so that we can suspend your service to prevent further usage. If your bill shows charges to your phone after the loss but before you reported it and want a credit for those charges, we will investigate your account activity. You do not have to pay the charges you dispute while they're being investigated to determine whether the charges resulted from usage by someone not authorized to use the phone. Further, in the event we haven't given you a courtesy suspension of recurring monthly fees within the prior year, we'll give you one for 30 days or until you replace or recover your wireless phone, whichever comes first. You may need to provide further information regarding the theft or loss if we ask for it. That's in the contract up front. Finally, while the intent of the bill is addressed through the sheer nature of the competitive marketplace, we fear that this bill as written would be preempted by federal law dealing with the regulation of wireless service and rates at the state level. Again, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, all three of you. Representative Junkie?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testifiers. Representative Lash, if I was dealing with T-Mobile, I'd be putting the bill in, too, after hearing the explanation from them that $200 or $400 or whatever was still outstanding. And I appreciate AT&T talking and laying out what would happen there, because I assume from what I heard from them, your client would not have any bill had they been with AT&T, because they allow them to look at their bill, and anything that's in dispute, the president said they would cancel. And so I appreciate that, but then again I want to ask Verizon, since I can't have an AT&T and an iPhone in Wilmer, Representative Lash, because they don't cover my area. I just want to bring that up. But I do have Altel and a phone that now Verizon owns. Is that the way you would handle it, the way AT&T, if one of my customers' kids, just like this, loses a phone and it takes me a month or two before I see my bill and it runs up? Would you just reduce 80% of those charges, or would you give me an opportunity to erase all of them?
Mr. McDermott?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Junkie, if you were to contact Verizon Wireless, we have a good faith relationship with you, with your constituents. We have 83 million customers, in a great deal here in Minnesota. I can't disclose how many, but we are the largest provider in Minnesota. Every case is unique. Our customer care folks are trained to examine these issues as they come up on a case-by-case basis. If you add fraudulent charges on your bill or your constituent's bill or your children's bill, we would remove 100% of that of those fraudulent charges. And if there is a if Mr. Bass suggested, if it's close, the deference goes to the consumer every time. Thank you.
Ms. Harris?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie, I understand your concerns and what you're saying, and maybe I need to give a little bit more context to this. We handle our cases in the same or similar way to AT&T and Verizon. There isn't a set amount that we require someone to pay. We often erase all of the charges, and we certainly, once we receive notice of a lost or stolen cell phone, stop all charges from that point forward. When we talk to a customer, we do a variety of things, including comparing bill histories, talking with the customer about authorized usage, and in this case, there was a negotiated agreement for us to take off $1,026 of that bill based on the discussions between the consumer and T-Mobile.
And Mr. Bash, I want to add something, and Representative Gardner after that.
Through you, Mr. Chair, to Representative Junkie. Just for a point of clarification, up to the point that the phone was stolen, if they had normal usage in there, they would be responsible for that. But from the time we realized that it was stolen, and then if we looked in and around that period of time, we'll eliminate those charges. But it's not, we don't zero out the bill. If they had their normal usage, we would go back to the point in time when...
Right. And Mr. Chair, what I appreciate was allowing the customer to go back and say, we think it was stolen about this day, and then you ask them, did you make those calls? Are they people, I mean, you can dial it up with them. You know, John Lash? No, I have no idea who he is. Thank you. He didn't call you. You know, it's not that difficult to figure out. So if your client had anything left on their phone that he was disputing and you're still charging him for, that's wrong. Because it's not that hard to figure out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duffy, I think part of the difficulty in this situation was that the line was activated 45. There was only 45 days of activity on the phone, so there was some difficulty there. There was also some difficulty presented because of the way that the consumer handled the phone loss situation by reactivating the phone while the phone was still not within his control. And so there was some confusion over what exactly took place. And that confusion happened. What I think the point that you're hearing from all these folks, including T-Mobile, is that we do have very, very open policies in place to allow consumers to challenge their bills, to go back and review the authorized and unauthorized charges. And you're right, we can look at histories where there are histories available to determine whether the usage is familiar or unfamiliar. In some cases, those questions are harder to answer, and this may have been one of those. For the most part, I think you'll find that there are very few complaints across the board for issues like these. I think these companies are competitive enough and are in a situation where they want their clients to stay, they want the consumers to stay with those companies. They'll do everything they can to make that work. There are some situations, obviously, and this one may be one of those, where the questions still remain.
Mr. McGarrett, briefly?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I need to call something I meant to mention. I handle 8 states for Verizon, and I receive escalated complaints from public utility commissions, better business bureaus, state attorneys general, representatives and senators in all of the states who receive constituent complaints to them directly. And we have a process, an escalated complaint process, executive relations it's called. And through all of those mechanisms that people can escalate their complaints, this issue doesn't even rank. The issue of people not receiving a favorable resolution to lost and stolen phones, it's I think really the deepest recesses of our consumer base that would suffer this frustration of not being able to get this resolved. But we can very easily determine if someone's moved away from that call pattern and credit goes back quite easily. It's just not a problem we see very often, to be honest with you.
Very good. Members, we're going to wrap it up here in the next 5 minutes, but we still have a few questions we want to deal with. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's a question for the bill's author. I'm assuming the word notice in 1.14, you're saying receipt by the provider of notice. I'm assuming that can mean people can call as well as write. Representative Lane's got a bill up on just this issue in a half an hour for homeowners making warranty claims, and people who've made notice by phone apparently didn't get covered, but I'm assuming that could be written or by phone where someone says, my stuff got stolen. Maybe it's for the testifiers to see what their interpretation is.
Well, that sounds right.
And just make sure people actually know which way they got to make notice.
If I can, I mean, this is a proof issue, and speaking as an attorney, I always recommend you make notice on something you can prove, because that's one of the major problems is you call in and you say you called, and, well, you know, the company doesn't have a record of your call. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but the burden's on you to establish that. So is your question that you'd like it clarified that notice can be by phone? Was that the question?
Justin Gardner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, if you're the attorney, I'll let you handle the details,
okay,
but that's the question I'm wondering about.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. To that point,
yeah, Mr. Chair, members, all of our policies allow for oral communication of a lost or stolen cell phone. So when you call the company immediately upon giving us notice, you will not incur any charges from that moment forward in any of our policies.
Very good. Representative Kickmeyer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, in regards to reporting of a lost or stolen or reinstatement or so on, Are there any fees such as reinstatement, especially if you report a loss and call back later reinstated, because you don't want to create a disincentive to do that, and if there's a fee involved. So can you just clarify here for us in regards to reporting or reinstating?
Mr. Beth?
Chairman Johnson, through you to Representative Kiffmeyer, from AT&T there's no charge. There's no charge to suspend or reactivate or deactivate that particular phone line.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. McGill?
To my knowledge, and I will say that I don't believe there is a reactivation fee, but because I'm not 100% certain, I would like the opportunity to report back to the Mr. Reich. That is definitively our position.
Yep. Sounds like a reasonable plan. Well, I think we're winding down. First, unless any closing comments you want to make, we are going to lay this matter over, but we all know you as a very reasonable man.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason has a brief question here, too, I believe.
I just wanted to make a comment. A few years ago, I had occasion to lose a phone with one of the vendors that's not represented here. And again, it was a real, very simple thing of just reporting it, and as it happened, nobody ever seemed to use the phone, so it was, must have been truly lost. And eventually, all I had to do to get a new phone was just sign up for a new contract. There was no extra cost involved.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie actually reminded me of one other thing. Anyone who may be impacted by the All-Tel integration or the Rural Cellular integration or any matter related to Verizon Wireless, and I'm sure AT&T and Sprint and T-Mobile feel the same way, please contact us directly if you have any consumer issues that we could help address those quickly and not create any further angst for the consumer. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Les?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Now, I know all of you have a cell phone because I've seen you yakking on them on the floor, which sometimes things get long. But I wondered if, with the Chair's permission, if I could ask for a show of hands, how many of you have read your terms of service? Okay, two people. Now, I would ask, you know, of those two, how many of you understood them?
Well, I ain't that bright.
Okay. Now, the reason I ask that is I haven't read my terms of service, but I know when I get on the phone with some of these people, with the few sometimes, it's like, well, it's clearly written in your terms of service. And, you know, it's in fine print that I need a magnifying glass to see. Remember that there's this difficulty when you're a consumer of calling in, and maybe all of us here on the committee can just call the lobbyists and have this all taken care of, but we're making laws for our constituents. If it was just, you know, take care of ourselves, that'd be one thing, but we want to make sure that the average constituent who calls in has the same opportunities as any one of us. And when you call in, because I've done this many times, you get one person, they send you a different department. Well, that's not my department, that's the billing department. It's really, really difficult to ensure that your rights are vindicated. Now, there's an old principle of contract law. You construe a contract against its maker. The principle of that is, you know, if you've got a cake and there's two brothers and they're deciding who gets the bigger piece of that cake, you let one brother cut the cake of which side's going to be bigger. But then you let the other guy decide which piece he gets. And you know that when that decision is made, that cake is going to be cut with razor sharp precision down the middle, because the person wants to make sure that the fair decision is made, because the person who's cutting the cake is the one who doesn't get the advantage. It's the same principle in this situation, and I think this law would make sure that the benefit of the doubt is given to the consumer. Now, the companies. Big companies have sat up here and said, "No, listen, we take care of our customers," and I'm sure that's the intent. If you ask the presidents and you ask the government relations people, do we take care of our customers? Absolutely, because what's their reason? Well, they could just go somewhere else. They could go to another provider. But remember, these are giants fighting against each other for market share. There's an old African proverb that goes, "When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers."
And oftentimes it's the consumers are the ones that get trampled here. And they don't have an opportunity with the complexity of the language and contract law to know whether or not their rights can be vindicated when the technology changes so quickly, when the laws change so quickly. So this is just a basic effort to ensure that fairness is implemented. I would also note that in the Senate yesterday, the 60-day language was reduced even more to 20 days. Which I think is probably a reasonable amount of time. But as I stated, remember, I'm on automatic bill pay, for example, and my cell phone bill is about $220 a month on average because all the stuff that I have in there. And that's for a data plan and an air card that I have plus a family plan. I know that it automatically gets paid every month because if it doesn't automatically get paid, I'll be late, I know. There was a situation several years ago where it was the middle of legislative session and Sprint put something on my bill of $180. It was a duplicated line item that shouldn't have been on there. And I didn't get to it, intending to dispute it later because it was in the middle of legislative session. I didn't have time to wait through a voicemail maze. And it was the end of session, sure enough, they said, nope, that's on. You didn't dispute it in the correct amount of time, and it's the only black mark I have on my credit report. It's the only thing. Everything else is fine. My credit report is pristine except for that one incident, and I'm still bitter about that, so it's too bad Sprint isn't up here. But anyway, thank you, members. It is being laid over, and I'd appreciate your support when it comes back, when we work out all the details.
Thank you, Representative Lust, and the matter is laid over. If there's no further issues, meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.